Hello, everyone. Welcome to a new episode of Tech Can Save Us podcast brought to you by Little Humans. As always, I am Paul David, founder and CEO of Little Humans and your host. And I'm joined today by Gary Bonilla, co-founder of Goodmora. And we're going to talk about reimagining brand strategy for the AI era, a topic that is near and dear to the work that we do at Little Humans. Welcome to the pod, Gary.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here. I love the name, by the way.
Thank you.
Tech Can Save Us, because it's one of the tenets in Goodmora, right? This is a human-machine collaboration. We'll talk about that in a second, but just wanted to say, love the name.
As an agency that does a lot of brand strategy, we take naming things very seriously. So that includes ourselves, our podcast, and we work with our clients on that too. So thanks. Nice to be noticed for that. I'm going to jump into a very long and well-deserved introduction of the good work you've done, Gary. And I don't think we have in here. There used to be a TV host, used to be a reporter, right? For ABC News.
Yeah, that's how I started way back as a television reporter. And then I moved into advertising at Saatchi for a very long time, where I became a strategist. And I'm taking, by the way, this is your introduction. You take over.
Yeah, no. Well, I'll just, for our audience, we're joined today by Gary Bonilla, co-founder of Goodmora, a company that's helping organizations reimagine strategy through the lens of AI and structural intelligence. We're going to dig into what that means a bit later. Gary's work sits at the intersection of brand, creativity, and systems thinking. Before founding Goodmora, he helped senior strategy leadership roles at Nickelodeon, where he helped revive icons like SpongeBob SquarePants. I was just talking about Squidward the other day. I didn't realize he's called Calamardo.
Yes.
My R's are terrible. In Mexico, at least. Is it the same in
Puerto Rico? That's right. Yeah. That's right.
Also, Dora the Explorer. We actually helped one of our biggest brands. They have a Dora Explorer-like navigator, one of our clients, as like their kind of brand avatar. So thank you for that.
Very nice.
And later at Interpublic Group, where he led strategy for global businesses and brand portfolios, including Nestle and Unilever, some small outfits that people may have
heard of. Some very small, uncomplicated brands and businesses.
Tiny.
Yes.
And now at Goodmora, Gary and his team are pioneering structural intelligence, which is AI-powered tools that make the hidden architecture of business visible, measurable, and adaptable. Their work helps leaders simulate strategy before they spend. Brilliant idea. Turning transformation from guesswork into science. And Gary, I feel like we're going to be working together because this is like all the stuff we need. So welcome to the pod again.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here.
Very exciting. Of course. Well, let's jump in. So we're going to start with a high-level question and kind of ask you to paint a picture of the landscape for our audience, as we typically do. We'd like to understand how AI is transforming the way brands build trust and differentiate themselves. And also just acknowledging that, you know, many companies today, they're experimenting with AI and marketing. We're one of them, but few are kind of rethinking their strategy structures, which is something we're right in the middle of. So tell us how AI is changing what brand differentiation, brand positioning means today.
Yeah. So do you mind if I start with a bit of background that we haven't talked about, or how I got here, right? How did I get here? I feel like I'm singing a song. He started, as you said, as a reporter. Then because of my analytical skills, as I moved into more corporate job in advertising and eventually on the client side, I kind of fell naturally into the strategy position, right? And spent many, many years solving very complicated, intractable problems for clients and trying to understand, you know, what's the easiest path to success. Transformation and change for clients, it's a business that has 70% failure. You know, it's trillions of dollars that are wasted yearly on transformation by the bigger, all the way through, but mostly the bigger corporates. And for me, there's also the element that these things need to happen in an agile way. The competition and the speed to market is increasing by the minute and by the second. And when you spend a year trying to figure out a transformation that eventually has a 30% chance of being successful, something's not wrong. It's not right with the model. So in 2016, while I was finishing my tenure at IPG, I began working with a lot of early AI companies trying to understand what databases could do for us, right? Like which I'm like everybody, I was a bit of like the non-believer, right? Like my amazing human brain will never be substituted by machines. Little did we know, right? Like there are parts that the machine do better that open up the space for us to then solutionizing much better. Eventually I got there and I began thinking about if we're able to pilot transformations ahead at a low risk to clients and to brands, That's a winner, right? Because one, you're changing the model from being a failure-led model to being a success-led model, but also you're allowing the C-suite to really take control of the big idea that they want to embrace for change. I started doing that before. I started doing pilots before AI. I did it quite successfully for some other global brands, including the number two water company in the world. And I realized there was a business there, right? But then we kicked it up a notch by bringing in AI, which has been a 2-year development. And now I'm going to answer directly your question, right? Like, I think brands are using AI as an add-on still. It's seen as an efficiency play, changing not as fast as it should, because the technology is moving so quickly, right? So there's a lot that executives and strategists need to catch up on with. This AI that's being added into companies automates parts of the organization, build a lot of efficiencies. As we have been reading on the headlines, they get rid of a lot of people as well, which is not necessarily what the solution should be, and not at least short term, because that will balance itself longer term with different things. And that's a whole other podcast we can talk about. But I do think that they're not being strategic, meaning AI is now capable to really understand organizations from beginning to the end through the years. It's able to, with graph databases, which is my favorite technology these days, not the newest, but my favorite these days. I think it's able to actually build really strong stories, data stories, to really understand what gaps and opportunities are. That space is a space consulting firms, the Big Four and the MBBs, have been trying to capture, but they themselves continue to make the choice of going with execution efficiency-driven AI platforms. Now we have, I'm going to be slightly reductive, but we have two types of AI, or let's say three types of AI. We had our friends that we use online, like Chat and Claude and all those, and that's quite interesting, quite open to the world, a little bit risky that way. And then there is really strong efficiency platforms that help people automate some of the work that's happening, and that has a really strong benefit for their consumers at the end of the day, or their customers at the end of the day. And there's a third category, which is the intelligence category, which is where we sit. And these are, highly analytical, thoughtful, organizing AI technologies that work together to be able to do what we do at Gudmora, the revealing of a business structure, the revealing of the gaps, and the ability to simulate any changes to improve that structure in the future.
Yeah, you touched on a couple of interesting points here. I mean, there's this whole piece about, AI allowing us and allowing brands to be more human. You touched on the sort of evolving relationship between creativity and data. And then what you sort of were implying, I think, but you've said this out loud, that, adaptability is now the real competitive edge. And I really feel that as a business owner. I feel like I'm grasping at straws to just keep pace and make sure my team keeps pace and is trained up and skilled up. So help us understand, like, what does an adaptive brand truly look like in practice in this new age of AI?
When I was in the advertising world way back, right, I used to walk into a creative meeting and, my role there was to be Nanny McPhee for all the creatives as a strategist with a brief in hand. I've always been a system thinker. I haven't been a brief campaign thinker. I think there are other people that are much better at that. So I always brought this idea of what are we thinking? How is it going to fit into the larger business and the larger experience? Fast forward 10 years, that's exactly the way we treat it, right? And I start with that because one of the phrases I used to say to creatives who were always willing to go super extra, super outside, paint outside the lines, like really go crazy, which is a wonderful thing to have, was, there's seven mandatory inclusions from the client, and they're going to set you free. Because once you internalize those, then you know exactly what your canvas space is, and you can go to town and play as much as you want. I think that's very liberating. It was a concept that during those days, pre-digital days in advertising, was hard to understand, but I stood firmly behind it. And I think that's also what makes, that's one of the rules of adaptability. Know what your configuration is, where you're playing. And AI provides that space, provides that configuration. You notice that I haven't used the word limits at all in the process, right? It sets up a really nice playground to then go and have fun, right? So brands that understand that are moving really quick, right? There was a lot of criticism around Duolingo's decision to fully operate on an AI basis, or at least have employees that are really knowledgeable in AI so that they can design their own functions as AI objects. Now, the criticism was, you're making people get rid of their own jobs. No, the answer there is, you're allowing people to understand the potential of the human brain and how it can, with a machine, work much in a much more impactful way. Now, you and I probably both use Duolingo. You were in Amsterdam the other day, so I imagined you did a little bit of quick Dutch lessons. I do it because the same, I travel a lot. I'm very culturally curious and I'm trilingual by birth. So I use it because I like to expand that. And I have seen how the product has gotten so much better. And because I'm in the AI enterprise business, enterprise design business, I can tell what is a machine solution and what's a human solution and where the two came together. And it is such a pleasure to actually learn languages now this way. So that's an adaptable brand, you know? And when you allow the technology to set the blueprint for where you need to play and find the right solution, that means that your entire time that you have for solutionizing will be spent in the right space. All
What
right.
a
And then you.
valuable, like valuable thing for a business to like, there's so much time wasted just trying to figure out, are we in the right space? Are we not in the right space? And then getting teams to be in that space to create solutions and products and things like that. That's brilliant.
And by the way, you saw that during the I mean, for some people, it's still the transition era. For people like you and me, we're already over the chasm, right? Like, it's a thing that's going to stay here. But in the earlier transition era, even in the digital transition era, right? We saw it a lot because you had people who did not understand the technology and how the technology could help coming to meetings and clashing with people who really understood the possibilities of the technology, but potentially did not have the were not in the right order in the pecking order, right? To be able to make the decisions. And it just made things really slow. One of my criticisms of my former brand and advertising industry is that they spent a lot of time trying to figure out that clash versus really, opening up the space for the digital people to come in and do things. There's such different languages. And with AI, it's a third language, right? Third, let's call it business language that we have to use. That there's the lesson for me in the digital transformation era is you need to trust the people coming with a new IP and allow them to play. I can understand why there's, some perceived risk around that at the corporate level, at the brand level to do it. But the quicker that people can get over that, the sooner they will see the results of including AI into a brand behavior, right? Into their brand.
I love that idea of brand behavior, and you use the verb play, which we take really seriously. Little Human is one of our values is professionally playful, which I think is particularly powerful for to get from a gaming company for creative industries, which are, in many ways, like the question, the reckoning has come with AI and in terms of, creative industries. So we'd love to get to this question. You mentioned the term structural intelligence, and I don't think it's a term that many people in our audience would know or understand. So if you can break it down for our audience, like what is it and how does it help organizations stay resilient?
Yeah, and I really appreciate you honing on that. I think some of the mystery we've built around structured intelligence is on purpose, is to allow people to ask the questions, but it's exactly what it says. It is the intelligence that comes from understanding a structure of a business. We only a percentage of our brain, even for very smart consultants, I'm not included in that space, only a percentage of our brain is capable to look at a problem and understand what the solutions are. And that's just a function of physiognomy and biology. It doesn't have that problem. Particularly graph database doesn't have that problem. It's able to really see every node or every entity that forms your business. I'll give you an example. It will see your brand, and then it will see under your brand 7 to 10 other entities, right? That give that brand the value it deserves or the role it deserves within the organization. And under those 12, there are relationships that those 12 entities have to all other entities and sub-entities in your organization. And that's that's just a classic business ontology. What we've done is we've taken that and we've turned that into a structure that graph database can read by looking at the financial and annual financial reports, strategic documents, and annual reports of organizations in a very binary way. You know, emotionally as a CEO, I may say, I have an AI strategy, we're going to buy a company, and then we're going to help that company embed itself into an organization and train everybody here to do it. That's great, right? And I'm sure there's a lot of depth behind that statement. But the reality is that when you look at the structure of your organization, you have to understand how many people are engaged with that topic. How does that create shareholder value? Because the way you implement that embedding of the new organization needs to create shareholder value for you to continue earning the right to the budgets that are going to allow that to happen, right? Mm-hmm. All those things can only be done with microscopic, telescopic and microscopic view at the same time. I used to like to say, as a strategist, I don't want to leave any stone unturned. Mm-hmm. That was the biggest point of suffering for me, because at the end of every strategic engagement, I knew there were stones that were not unturned, that were not turned. It had to do with timing. A audit of a business takes, the right audit of business takes at least 6 months by a bunch of analysts, 17 analysts at one point I used to do that. Mm-hmm. Then you have to work on the strategy and then you have to pilot it to see if it's going to work, which can take another year. Mm-hmm. And there's millions of dollars involved in that. By the time you get to a pilot, the C-suite either has changed or lost momentum.
Right.
Because of the speed that business, the speed in which business happens today. So the shorter you make the engagement, the better. That just became another problem in a failure-led industry, right? Mm-hmm. So by understanding from the very beginning, very clearly in a map, visual map of entities and relationships of entities, the story of your business and the current state of your business, and be able to compare it with other maps of other organizations and understand what's a path to success and use that to patch your own map and simulate. I know it sounds very sci-fi, but it's already happening. And simulate that change and see how the map reconfigures itself and the ripple effect around the entire organization. Yeah. That's a game changer.
It's so powerful. I mean, the way you're talking about mapping trust dynamics and decision flows to help companies better respond to disruption, even prevent, disruption in many ways. And you phrase it as a digital twin for strategy. Lord knows I wish I had that. I think that's a great way to sort of phrase it. I want to get to an example, if we can, of a business that's used this approach and used your tool to kind of uncover something surprising. I think you had an example of a health tech company. And I think that's a particularly interesting one, because I can't think of another sector in which you need to be more precise when you're dealing with people's, life and death and their health and things like that. So yeah, you can share that example with us.
Yeah, by all means. We've been 2 years in development. We've done all sorts of pilot experiments ourselves, for each of the components of our platform. We've just had our first end-to-end pilot for a healthcare provider out of the Middle East. And their ambition was to be AI first, which we should do another postcard about that, because I don't even know what that means. But be AI focused, right? To not just build efficiency inside the organization, but to expand the portfolio of their offers. Their ambition was in the right place and it was quite big, that they were not looking to compare themselves against other healthcare providers. They wanted to compare themselves with people like NVIDIA or people like Tesla, right? Which have lots of historical transformations in their young lives. And most than half of them have been quite successful. So those were the right analogs to look at, right? These are also people who make, for whom the cloud is critical to their business success. So that was something that in the structure of the company that we were working with was a similar. So they seem like they were the right analogs. Interesting. When we can identify the structure of a company in its detail, we don't have to compare within the same category anymore. So you're actually building, blue ocean strategy from the very beginning, because you're looking outside of your own category, which is quite interesting. So in their case, we're trying to figure out whether acquiring an AI IP, bringing it into the organization, that's why I made the reference earlier, or developing their own IP would be what would be best. There was a lot of conversation at the board level and at the C-suite level around what they could do and what they, how they yard of the possible of AI. I think what we saw was a lot of the cascading down was not effective because it were the work streams that they built around it were not attached to any commercial KPIs. 60% of the work streams were orphan in their strategy. We only saw that with a map. The board understood from the reports that they got from the operations team that they were 100% aligned with their KPIs. So only 60% were, and of the, I'm sorry, only 40%, 60% gap. Of the 40 that were, none of them were creating shareholder events or AI public events. And this is really important because when you looked at the analogs or the comparables that we use, most of their success in AI-driven transformation had to do with their ability to create really visible public events that shareholders attach their trust to.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, so many businesses, the struggle with connecting, like literally the things that they do every day to really clear ROI, shareholder value, you know, revenue, profitability. So taking that step back and mapping that and also saying, hey, we're going to look at your competitors is really powerful. I'd love to dig into some of the challenges that you're seeing out there, because there's a lot of leaders out there struggling with how to modernize their strategies. Where do you see companies struggling the most? And also, how do you convince leaders who always, they rely on intuition and legacy processes to embrace AI-powered strategy?
I think intuition is more important than ever. You know, and I'll piggyback on the case study that we were just sharing so I can bring the answer to your question to life. For a very long time, I'm old enough to know that there was a rule in the boardroom, which was that people with the title strategists would very hardly become CEOs. They were viewed as, you know, big art of the possible thinkers, grounded with a bit of knowledge of Excel. You know, it depends the industry, right? But they were never seen as people who could take concrete action as it relates to business solutions. I think that's very different in the last 10 years. I think in the consulting space and also in your space and in my former space, you're seeing strategies, real strategy, being more about how to get to agile solution making, right? Your strategy is as good as your execution. The time when you would separate the both, that's not longer a viable way to do business.
Yeah.
And I think you have a new generation that understands that very well. So let me start with that. You increasingly are seeing strategy people taking the helms of companies. But I will say that when we embed AI into our strategic design, right, strategies and their intuitions will be more important than ever. Because what's going to happen now is that probably I would remember a case that I did. My intuition, I would think, as I said before, there seems to be a stone I haven't turned, right? But I couldn't put my finger on which one was it. That's going to be visible to you now. So you're not going to be able to act on that intuition. It's going to be very supportive of your own solution-making process. I think generation of leaders continues to evolve. If you see the new blood and the new digital first, tech first CEOs and board members, as important as board members taking over, it's going to be a little bit different, right? You're going to see much more openness to allowing the machines to do some of the groundwork in the strategy side, not in the efficiency play, in the strategy side, and then creating the space for the strategies to really be creative.
Yeah. I really appreciate that point about, I mean, this is one thing we've come to in the past 5 years is just realizing that disconnect between strategy and execution and never decoupling the two. Because we worked on projects where we've had some, you know, highfalutin, high price strategy consultant who's kind of telling us what to do as sort of the agency and the execution team. And, you know, that caused a lot of friction. We've had engagements where, you know, we're the strategy consultant and, you know, someone else is doing the execution. And that obviously is a different type of friction. Now we sort of moved into a space where we just prefer to really own both in like a deep sort of long-term growth partnership with, you know, with our client partners.
That makes total sense.
Yeah.
I mean, this separation of church and state, the way they used to call it in mm-hmm. corporates, it's a construct for additional billing, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. right? It's a construct of human capacity, you know, time management and revenue.
Yeah.
That it's all model. That with AI doesn't necessarily need to be a factor as we're thinking through this work stream.
I'd love to dig into, you know, kind of, you talk about, you know, the hype around AI strategy and there's a lot of misconceptions out there. And you said, you know, people, you know, consider AI the strategy itself, but it's not. AI is just an enabler. So we'd love you to like, right. you know, expand on that. Cause I feel like that's a really important point for the moment right now.
Yeah. I mean, the first 2 years of our development, every time we spoke with investors or potential pilot clients, there were a couple of confusions. One is, they think like doing everything AI is the way you fix the company. And they would think that that's what we came in to do, that we were another consulting firm that just focused on AI transformation as opposed to Accenture digital transformation in the old days, right? But that's not the case. I mean, the solution doesn't necessarily need to be AI. AI is a tool that complements and or supplements other thinking and other tools that exist out there. What in our case is a perfect example of it, right? Like people say, are you an AI company? I'm like, it's really hard for me to say that. We're a strategy company that uses AI algorithm to make sure that we can be precise and de-risked.
Yeah, I think that shift, I think, is really critical. And a lot of companies are thinking about, you know, how do I reposition, you know, in light of that, and you know, like, because I think a lot of them they're not set up for strategy, being strategy led. You know, they've been, as you said, they've been tactics led. They've had these structures of services that are to the benefit of revenue, but not necessarily to clients. And I think there's a real reckoning, particularly in the agency world right now, of like, okay, like now you actually need to tie the strategy and tactics and execution to ROI, to shareholder value,
right.
to revenue.
That's right.
That's shocking to a lot of people, because if we're honest with ourselves, we've kind of dined out, you know, the information asymmetry between us and our clients, and you know, just overvalued companies. Like there's a lot there that is coming to a reckoning. But
it's, I mean, my message to the CEOs, because you're making an awesome point. I'm sorry to interrupt you. Got excited about something you said there for a second. But my message to CEOs, and I'm thinking of a couple in my head that I worked with, is the time where you had, when your role was most of it delegating to then put the pieces together, it's over, right? I think there is an opportunity for CEOs to be highly hands-on on solution making. The work streams are collapsing into one, right? Because of AI, because of technology. So if I were a CEO of one of the legacy companies, I would be thinking, oh, what a great opportunity this is for me to start playing again. Here's back that word that you mentioned before. Yeah. For me to start playing again. I remember as I was rising through the ranks in corporate that people would say to me, you must feel great. Now you're doing, you know, XYZ, you know, punching up, trying to get Dora to be number one in the world again, Dora the Explorer. But the reality is that the higher you get, the least you play. Because there is this coordination, negotiation that has to be done. Those things are important, but very important, right? But I think there's going to be less of that. And there's going to be more of like, we have very clear facts. And now we can go in and together play and make something really great here. That's what happened with the healthcare provider in Dubai. Mm-hmm. We spent our time trying to figure out what would be the right patch, what other companies had that patch already implemented, and then trying to play with a knowledge graph to see how the organization would change with each of the patches. For people who have the brain configured the way strategists and consultants do, that's a much happier place to be, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
More productive too.
Absolutely. That's really well said. Would love to just move on to just a sort of personal question about, you know, you've led global transformations for household names. You've learned a lot about what, you know, building brands that last looks like, feels like, should be structured. You've talked about structure, coherence, and empathy. I think that's an incredible point. We'd love to just hear a bit more about, you know, the work that you've done to kind of scale everything from entertainment franchises to health tech startups. What are the core principles that have carried you through those experiences? And how does your time reviving characters like SpongeBob and Dora shape the way you think about relevance and connection?
People love to talk about those two.
Yeah, sorry.
I mean, it's like, I also like to say interesting. I go through waves, right? Like people,
yeah,
I say those were my hardest working year because it was a very matrix organization that's, as you've seen in the press, it's gone through so many mergers, demergers, and mergers, right? And it has to do with a bit, some of it is money at the top and some of it is the way the organization is structured, right? But it was really very satisfying to do it. I arrived, and when I arrived, the two franchises had been losing ground with their core audiences, had grown with other audiences, but were not really the audiences that were going to pay for the bounty. So in entertainment, you have to think it's like in Star Wars terms, right? Like the content is kind of like the commercial. The content's the lure, but the bounty is really what's in Walmart, in the Walmart aisle and the Tesco aisle. That's, you know, and that's where the big money can be done. Some purists will say that's not the case, but ultimately that's how we made our margin and at Paramount, at Nickelodeon, most of the time. It was driven by consumer products and by licensing. So when I walk into those two engagements, those two jobs were very typical of my entire career. Mm-hmm. I walk in with an analyst head. I walk in and like, who, you know, where are we missing? What do you are we missing? How do we get to it? Mm-hmm. Who are the right people who can speak the language of these new views that now we're seeing? Bring them on board, mm-hmm. right? And now let's think about a system. So I never thought about SpongeBob. Let's make sure that he sells more t-shirts. That was a consequence at the end of the day.
Right.
I thought about what is the system that we need to reinvent here to address the changing nature of families and kids, right? Mm-hmm. The way they consume media. We were at that point really going through really high levels of gamification. People couldn't understand inside of Paramount why the number one selling SpongeBob object, for lack of a better, or asset, was the collab with MTV on a music video game. Right. So on a video music game, anyway, a game that music and video rock. It was called Rock Band, which you may remember from your younger days.
Yeah, I remember
Rock Band.
Yeah.
SpongeBob Rock Band, Rock the World.
Yeah.
And to me, that was a huge insight right there. That's exactly telling you where the system needs to go. That's kind of it. And I placed it in my strategy map at the very center of it. When I said, what are we missing? That's what we were missing. What's the view from there? So we need to look at this franchise very differently. These are not toddlers sitting in front of a TV, burping in front of their mom. This is actually like, this is much more engaging. This is about making music, creating culture. It's a language that's being developed. How do we harness that, right? And that really changed completely what we're doing. We went from being led by season tentpoles, which is what they call the big first episode of the season, to being more led by a more ample collection of content, like Broadway musicals, which ended up winning Tonys, and which were planned at the time, even though they came out 5 years later. You know, a whole gaming strategy and a whole short content strategy, right? Which for the creator of SpongeBob, may he rest in peace, was a really hard thing to do because the franchise was really about long storytelling, if you think about it, right? But it did became a successful model for them. And exactly the same model was applied to Dora the Explorer. That's not dissimilar to the model I had used for Diageo brands before that at Gray. And it's not dissimilar to the way that I approach the kids product portfolio for Nestle the year after, right?
Yeah.
Usually we see all those parts. So you think of a portfolio. Portfolio is like a franchise, right? Depends how you're dicing it. But you could think about how the products, which Procter does very well, help each other. How the different technologies that different products bring to the table, even though they don't seem related, shampoo versus fabric detergent, how those they can work together to optimize the technology you're using. That's what we did with SpongeBob and Dora, and that's what we did, and that's what I did, what I've done, what I've done.
Amazing. Amazing. Well, I'm going to do something I've never done the podcast before, and I'm going to invite you back live to a part two because this is just such a juicy conversation. So I want to have you into our podcast studio in London, and we'll do a part two follow-up because there's just so much here to dig into. For now, we'll skip the lightning round, but I want to ask you one final question that I'd be remiss if I didn't ask, which is about growth strategy. It's obviously something you thought about a lot in your various roles. How are you taking all that great, experience that you have at Nestle and Unilever and Nickelodeon, and turning that into a compelling growth strategy for Good Mora? You're in the early days, you've done some pilots. How are you gonna, how are you gonna fund it? How are you gonna staff it? What is that growth strategy? What are the pillars of that growth strategy as you grow Good Mora?
Yeah, so as you can imagine from the conversation we had, I'm quite, my favorite question is, how do you bite an elephant? Because, and I have to tell myself every morning, because so number one, I was born in an island called Puerto Rico, for those people who don't know, because I don't know where this is shown, but it's Bad Bunny Island. But before that, it was just a small island that's part of the US, a territory of the US, where corporate work is more about shared resources. I was very surprised when I got to the US and there was one person in charge of one thing when I was in charge of 10 in the island. So I have to learn to go slower and pace myself, which is a really good thing. I ask myself, how do I de-elephant today? How do I splice the bites? And right now, so we have a partner that deals with investments in my organization. We have a set date for a Series A next year after spring. But in the meantime, we're very, very thoughtful about having a very comprehensive pilot era. I want to make sure we uncover all our mistakes, that we make sure we find some early fans that can socialize us. We've been very lucky with the kind of clients that we have in our pipeline for our pilots, starting with the one that just came out, the healthcare company out of Dubai. We also have a very important cultural focus NGO out of the US. It's a global brand. That's going to be really interesting because we're living in times of does culture matter or not, as they look to rethink their business to regain the donations because they've lost a lot, right, over the past year. Then we also have two of the big four in our pipeline for pilots as well. So I think that's a very lucky position for us to be. We're inviting all big brands that are really afraid to let us, to try it out with us. It'll be a concierge process, and hopefully one will help them to help us refine the platform. And then more importantly, at the end of the day, they will go confidently in the direction of an AI transformation, of a
That's
world
great.
that's changing into AI-led strategies.
That's
So
amazing.
that's one. And then number two, as when January hits, I'll be switching hats from pilot to fundraising.
Okay.
But then we'll be going with really good meat on our hands.
Yeah. I mean, so many things you said there really jumped out at me as a founder, a fellow founder, slowing down, focusing on the things that matter. I love that you're investing in the pilot phase and just getting that right. 'Cause even as a marketer, I'm like, just get the product right. And maybe don't
Right.
need as much marketing. I'm humble enough to know that about my profession. Yeah, partnerships and culture. Those are things that we're over-indexing on as we work on growth strategies with our clients because we feel like that's the future. It's the now too, but it's in the AI era. It's getting those human things, those partnerships, those cultural touch points are getting more and more important. So
Do you also get in the morning when you wake up the I have 27,000 things that I need to do and they all need to be done yesterday?
exactly. Yeah.
Right. And then your brain tricks you before you meditate and tells you if you don't get them done, you'll be a failure.
Yeah.
And there's all these people counting on you. So this reminder of one thing at a time is really important.
It
One thing at
really
a time
is.
is really important. I
It
mean,
really is.
strategically, you have to be strategic about it. It's not like just one thing at a time, I'm going to sit here and wait
Yeah.
for an email. No, but it's quite philosophical, but it's quite fundamental. When you're present and you're doing things, focus on what you have in front of you. It's going to be quicker. It's going to be much highly successful. And there's enough proof that we don't have to do a whole podcast about this.
Yeah. Well, we're gonna do a part
So,
two for sure. We'll have to cut it there. I've so enjoyed this conversation, Gary. Like this is such a
me
treat.
too. I love hearing your questions and hearing about your experiences. that resonate with me. These things are therapy for me. So thank you.
Yeah, we'll do another one. We'll have you in the office. We'll have lunch. We'll do a strategy session, do another podcast follow-up. I just love the work that you're doing. And just thank you so much for joining us. We'll put in the show notes, links to your white paper, which is fantastic, and to your website so folks can support the fundraising that's happening next year. We just really appreciate you having the show. For our listeners, please give a review, give a rating to this episode so we can bring Gary back and bring on new, great guests as well, like Gary Bonilla, the founder of GoodMora.